Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Kevin Moore Show. I'm Kevin Moore, and it is a pleasure to be spending the next hour with you. Our opening musical selection was Promises, Promises, a wonderful song from the great composer Burt Bacharach. And that's what I have for all of you today, the promise that this next hour will be informative, interesting, provocative, and maybe even a little exciting. A promise that our discussions will give you something to think about today and hopefully something to talk about tomorrow. Or what I'd like to think of as a civilized hour of culture and conversation. Well, as I like to do to begin each of our shows, I like to read or share a recent poignant story or an especially interesting essay or some philosophical quotes or thoughts or sometimes even a little poetry that touches or speaks to us all. Well, I hope everyone enjoyed and had a very memorable Memorial Day. The weather was beautiful. I'd like to read something I enjoy reading every year, a couple times throughout the summer, because it kind of lets us get in touch with ourselves. It's entitled, Summer Shines as Ever, It's We Who Have Changed. Keep an eye on summer. That bit of lyric from the middle of an old song I have otherwise long forgotten reinsinuates itself into the atmosphere this time every year. It might as well be playing on every corner, although it's really not there. It might as well be emblazoned against the clouds like skywriting coming in soft white plumes from a sputtering biplane, although there are no words in the afternoon air. Memorial Day has come and gone. June, July, and August are on their way. Keep an eye on summer, yet we seldom do. Summer is life's greatest gift to us, or at least it ought to be. It's no coincidence that there have been more songs written about summer than about all the other seasons combined. Summertime, wonderful summer, all summer long, a summer song. Summer means fun. Whatever your generation, the songwriters and singers of your era were drawn to summer seemingly as if they couldn't help themselves. Summer is everything, at least it once was, when we were young. Then, when summer and life were new, summer represented freedom and friendship and an escape from the grayness of the rest of the year. Summer was not just a season. Summer was a reward, even when we hadn't done a thing to earn it. Summer was the time to breathe, to feel like someone else, to discover things about you that could never be discovered in November or February. Summer was the time when you were allowed to figure out who you were. As we grow older, we allow summer to lose that. Summer doesn't change. We do. The long days and warm nights that we used to cherish and linger over somehow become rushed and diminished because we don't pay proper attention. We have jobs now and responsibilities and deadlines to meet. There are times during the summer when, if someone were to ask us what month it is, we would have to hesitate for a second before figuring out whether it is June or July or August. Summer is a blur, or so we have permitted it to become. The one time of the year that should never be blurred. The one time of the year that should be clear and crisp and distinct. Every summer day is often anything but. It's not summer's fault. It's ours. One of the wisest people I have known once said that the best things in life should be thought of as pebbles in a jar. The assumption should be that the pebbles are finite. Even if you can't count them by looking into the jar, you should assume that one day they will run out. You should withdraw them with care, one by one, never doing it by rote or distractedly. If you withdraw them too rapidly, you're being greedy and will hasten the day when they're gone. If you hoard them, if you are miserly in keeping them in the jar, then you will rob yourself of the experiences the good things should give you. There's no perfect way to do it. The closest you can come to perfection is to know just how precious those pebbles are and to value each one. So it is with summers. Here is one true thing. You have one less summer remaining in your life than you did a year ago today. This is just after Memorial Day. A year from today, you'll have one less summer remaining than you do now. That can worry you or thrill you. Choose to let it thrill. Summer is just beginning. Why are we given summers? Well, probably for the reason that we are given all of life's good things, to remind us of what the rest of life does not feel like, to show us by contrast what we are missing during all those hours when things are not so fine. If all of life were summer, if all of our experiences were wonderful experiences, then the world would have no texture, no context. Summer, the possibility of summer, summer as we first knew it, is what it is precisely because we are aware its duration is not limitless. It would not taste the way it does if we thought it would last forever. We love it, or at least we once loved it, because we know, even as it is beginning, that it will soon enough be gone. That is why the last evening of summer is one of the most melancholy times of the year. The air is cooler on that September night. The shadows grow longer. There is a sadness on that night that is hard to shake. Not now, though. That's for later. It's just after Memorial Day. The pebbles fill summer's jar. Yours to withdraw at your own pace. Keep an eye on summer. Savor every day. Savor every summer night. Great essay. Summer is life's greatest gift to us, or at least it ought to be. And pebbles in a jar. Great way to start the season. Turning the page here into June, July, and August. Enjoy it. Savor every day. Savor every summer night. Simplifying and eliminating the unnecessary so that the necessary may speak is the guiding principle behind Quartino Ristorante and Wine Bar. Unprecedented cuisine begins by starting with the highest quality ingredients from exceedingly specialized producers across the world. Once the ingredients descend upon Quartino's kitchen, it is the ideal combination of time-honored techniques married with modern methods that allows John Coletta to highlight and showcase the core flavor of an ingredient. Quartino's is a bustling downtown Chicago restaurant and wine bar located at 626 North State, noted for its distinctive Italian small plates menu, vintage decor, and attentive, personable service staff. Chef and partner John Coletta has developed a menu featuring Italy's regional specialties, including artisanal salumi, Neapolitan thin crust pizza, house-made pasta, and seasonal dishes. Menu items served in moderate portions and meant to be shared are perfect for adventurous diners ready for a unique experience. John Coletta, a first-generation Italian-American, is a chef, restaurateur, author, and respected veteran in the Chicago and international culinary communities. As executive chef and managing partner of Quartino Ristorante and Wine Bar, John preserves the authenticity of regional Italian cuisine through honed culinary techniques and authentic Italian ingredients. And on the line with us right now is the award-winning chef driven by the philosophy of La Vera Cucina Italiana, the true Italian kitchen. John's talents has graced the St. Regis and Waldorf Astoria Hotels in New York City, Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, and the five-star Shangri-La Hotel in Singapore. A multi-gold medalist in the Culinary Olympics, John has led such popular Chicago restaurants as Entre Nous and Primavera at the Fairmont Hotel, Calatera and Carlucci's. A native New Yorker and first-generation Italian-American, John is a best-selling author of books on Italian cuisine, has been seen on PBS, featured in numerous periodicals, and is one of the brightest stars in the world of culinary arts in Chicago, and the executive chef and managing partner of Quartino Ristorante and Bar, located at 626 North State, our good friend, Mr. John Coletta. John, welcome to the Kevin Moore Show.
It's a pleasure to be here, Kevin. All is well.
It's great to have you. And congratulations on the continuing success that Quartino's Ristorante and Wine Bar has enjoyed. And, boy, every time you go in there, the place is packed, so you're doing something right, Johnny.
Well, you know, we're continuously searching the market in order to bring the great, authentic products to our customers. The more that we focus and evolve, obviously, you know, the customer has an affinity for that and really, really gravitates to, you know, some of the newer things, some of the familiar things, and some of the things that are just done the way they were meant to be done. So there's a tremendous focus from everyone on our staff in order to achieve these results. And again, doing this in a very approachable format, in a way that people really understand it. We're not speaking over anyone's head. In fact, we're speaking directly to them in a way that they may or may not have had that experience, but this experience is one that they'll remember and often talk about and come back to try as often as they can.
Well, of course, we're unified by a common denominator because we both grew up in an Italian family. And if there's one word that you can use for an Italian family or an Italian kitchen, it's welcoming. And I think that reflects what you have at Quartino. The people are welcoming. The dishes are welcoming. There's, you know, no effects are put on. Everybody feels that it's accessible. And I think that's what brings people back, because they know there's a consistency there they may not get somewhere else.
No question. You know, I always say, you know, would you invite someone to your home and then insult them? You know, when a customer comes to Quartino, we welcome them. We hug them. That's the first step. The next step is our service staff takes over and delivers this friendly, focused experience that they'll very rarely get. More importantly, it's done, like as you said, in a welcoming manner. And the food has to be flavorful. I mean, it's a given today to have good food. And, you know, being able to do it in an approachable format, and approachable means a lot of things to a lot of people, but to do it in a way that it's non-intimidating. You know, we started doing these salumis where we're no longer grinding the meat. We are cutting it by hand. We're making sausages. You know, everyone says artisanal sausages, but an artisan doesn't have a meat grinder. An artisan's got a knife, he's got a board, he's got some spices, some wine, and then he goes to work, right? And those are real artisans. And again, you know, that's the way sausages were meant to be eaten. And, you know, we're starting this. And again, you know, there are some comments from customers that say, you know, it's a little bit odd. It's odd because, you know, the technology has taken over in as much as we've become very efficient. You know, we can take 100 pounds of meat and grind it in a matter of minutes, but to, you know, dice 100 pounds of meat takes several hours. So, you know, we've taken those steps, and each step we take, whether it is for the spice that has to come from Italy, or it's our tomatoes, or any of the preparations that are done with just tremendous focus. You know, that is the essence of, you know, an Italian family, of the Italian culture, and more importantly, of bringing family, friends, and associates together, and the food and the wine is the medium, right? It's more about the camaraderie, and the food is a given in any Italian family, or even in Italy. The food's got to be just great.
Sure, sure. I remember my youngest son, of course, I'll compliment you now. Of course, you have one that's at St. Ignatius. I had four at St. Ignatius, and one of them went over to study at Loyola of Rome, and it was one of the greatest experiences going over the Rome and eating, going from one restaurant to the next, eating. It was just terrific, because what they do is much like what you do, John, is you have a whole bunch of different kind of offerings and antipasti and prima piatti and secondo piatti, and you take a little bit here, a little bit there, and you just spend hours enjoying each other's company over the great food that you're also having time spent with.
Absolutely. You know, the Italian culture, is, as you know, is composed of 20 different regions bringing to the table 20 different approaches. So think of the depth that Italy has. You know, the usage of just a simple grain of rice can be done in thousands and thousands of manners. And, you know, too often we see them, you know, in a risotto format or in a arancini format, but there are thousands of applications. You know, Italy is a blessed, blessed land. They've had a lot of time to experiment and to find out. You know, there's over 850 different varieties of olives, and the same is true for grape varietals. You know, the Sangiovese cloned grape varietal is over 800. So just think of the depth and the efforts that are made, and too often, you know, they're done in a very, I want to say, humble manner. The Italians don't go and beat their chest and say this is the best and this is the greatest. They say, you enjoy it and you tell us. They know very well that these products are superior and that the experiences are just incredible. And, you know, replicating that here at Quartino, you know, especially in the great city of Chicago where, you know, it is just a tremendous place to live. It's the greatest place in the world to live. And having a restaurant like Quartino and having this kind of food and service and wine allows Chicago to really stand heads and shoulders above everyone else. So yeah, I can't say enough great things about what's going on with our entire staff and our wine and food programs that we're developing. And each day we just make one better step. You know, polishing that apple, so to speak, every day is you know, the motivating factor for us.
Now, John, what made you pursue the field of the culinary arts? Was this preordained that John Coletta would be a chef or a great restaurateur when he was younger? Something you always wanted to do or studied for, your family was involved in?
Yes, my family grew up in it, and then obviously I had four brothers that never chose to do this. I never thought about doing anything else. It was like getting on a bicycle and I never got off. I just kept pedaling. And I approach food today just as I did when I was a young kid. You know, I can't get enough of it. I go to bed every night thinking, what am I going to make tomorrow morning? I get up in the morning and I start to think, maybe I should just change this just a slight bit, make this even better. You know, we had a problem with this preparation. I need to solve this. So it is just, I don't know. To me, it's very exciting and incredibly rewarding. The people that I've met, the customers, I mean, it's just an exciting field. And food is a very, you know, if you take a step back, it's just food, meaning it's just a very simple, ordinary process. But with so many layers and so many approaches, you know, you just take pancetta, for example, in Italy, 20 regions, you're going to see 20 different approaches to making pancetta. And, you know, that to me is just so inspiring because each one does make it in their own way so well and so perfectly, and you want to savor those things. And each one has its own thought process. And for that, you know, to me, I feel so enriched. And, you know, I don't believe I have mastered 0.0001%, you know.
Well, we're all in trouble then, John.
Well, you know, when you look at, you know, the depth of food and forget about other cultures and countries, just take, you know, just the Italian culture. It is so deep. Oftentimes it's forgotten about. It's, you know, viewed as not being, that anybody can do it, and, you know, it isn't very sophisticated. And to the contrary, it's extremely sophisticated. If you look very, very deep, you know, we talk about farm to table today. I mean, that started several thousands of years ago in Italy. That's nothing new. I mean, it was always, there wasn't another place to get the food from. So it had to come from the farm. And guess what? We were going to eat at a table. So all of this together was made for such an exciting time, which brings a very, very valid point today. We need to know where the materials originate from. Mm-hmm. We need to know how that pork has been treated. And it's the same way. You know, even today in Italy, salumis are cut by hand. It's rare. I mean, much of it is done mechanically. But there is just this strict understanding that if I treat this animal in this very humane way, chances are I'm really going to produce products that are superior. You know, each part of the animal needs to be understood and how it should be cooked. That is the secret to cooking great food, irregardless and irrespective of the cuisine or the culture. But if we understand all of these things, that our vegetables do not need pesticides, what they, you know, they need to be nurtured as they were meant to be enjoyed, then the food automatically tastes better, right?
So there's a science to all this besides the practicality of just the eating of the food.
I believe that there is an understanding.
Yeah.
If you understand that you are what you eat, and if you go back to treat this animal the way it should be treated, you know, with a lot of reverence and understanding, of course we slaughter the animal, but utilizing each and every piece to its fullest and understanding how it should be cooked and how it shouldn't be cooked, and the appropriate vegetables, using them in season. You know, you go to the markets today and, you know, you see Tuscan kale 12 months out of the year, or better known as Cavolo Nero. And, you know, you see all of these things, or strawberries 12 months out of the year. You know, the product gets diluted. You know, for a while there, the marketplace discovered heirloom tomatoes, and then someone decided, well, you know, we can have those 12 months out of the year. And we've diluted the product. The more we do these kinds of things, it, you know, erodes that incredible food experience. Coming out of winter, we should be excited about, you know, asparagus and fava beans and all the wonderful vegetables that spring has to bring. But when you can get fava beans year-round, I don't know how excited you're going to be about them.
Well, you know, I'm using tomatoes as an example. I love tomatoes, and I always look forward to the middle to latter part of the summer when you can get the great yellow tomato. But you have tomatoes in the middle of winter, and they don't taste like tomatoes, John.
They can't. They really cannot. Unfortunately, and we hold, you know, in as much as I'm about to speak on both sides of my mouth, we do serve fresh tomatoes 12 months out of the year because there's a customer demand for it. The customer demands that product. From time to time, we're going to get complaints from people like yourself or people like myself or someone who really has a passion and affinity for flavor. They're going to wait till July and August to have these spectacular tomatoes, and then they'll enjoy them in preserved formats throughout the rest of the year. But a fresh tomato, there's nothing better than taking a tomato off of the vine, slicing it into thick pieces, drizzling some superior extra virgin olive oil, some cracked pepper, a little bit of basil, a touch of sea salt. I mean, you're in heaven. It's that simple. But that approach...
I'm salivating here, Jeff.
That approach just takes a lot of understanding and time. And, we're in a busy, busy culture. You know, we don't have time for all of these things that, you know, let's say our parents had or our grandparents had. And for that, these things are being diluted. You know, in Italy, the slow food movement recognized this 30 years ago and said, you know, we're going to slow down the way we process food. We're going to go back to the ways that our grandparents did these things and, you know, really take the true artisan approach. Now, granted, it is not you cannot do this for the mass market because of, you know, cost barriers, but whenever possible, we should be eating food in season, and that should be a given. We should try to stay away from pesticides and, you know, genetically modified products and GMOs and all of this sort of thing because, number one, they're not good for us. You know, we see all these allergies that people have today.
Sure.
You know, the gluten intolerance and so on. Much of it is linked to the usage of GMOs. I mean, and certainly in Europe and in Italy, they won't do this. And, you know, again, it's all a function of economics. And, you know, food is clearly twice the price that food is here in the States, but portions are smaller. So, you know, there's a way of balancing all of that. And on top of it, the passion for, let's say, we are going to barter. You're going to make olive oil. I'm going to make salumis. Someone else is going to preserve some products. Another guy is going to make some cheese. And among us, we trade, and we are going to do the best we can because we really are proud of what we're making. We don't, you know, that we don't have the time for that, especially in an urban environment such as Chicago or New York or any big city. But, you know, just think of the incredible food experiences they get to have, and they won't sell it. I mean, that is just traded among themselves in their own little village or town, and they certainly have their issues, but when it comes to food, the experiences are typically superior for those reasons.
You know, we touched upon this a little earlier in our conversation here, John, and that is, do you see, as long as you've been in the business of the culinary arts and the restaurant business, more of an awareness for people now as to what's what they like, what their preferences are to eat, the small portions versus the large portions and so forth, than it was in the past?
Absolutely. I think people, you know, through the help of the media, through the help of the Food Network and varieties of other medias, there is such an awareness for food today, and that's a worldwide awareness. So we want to know the origin of the product. And in addition, we want to eat just a smaller amount of it. That's an economic force that causes that to happen, right? I mean, if we, you know, just take a very simple cannoli. You know, at the end of that cannoli, you can either put chocolates or you use pistachios or whatever the product is. But if we're not using pistachios, and, you know, food manufacturers, in as much as they've done some very amazing things, they've also done some things to train us in a way to accept artificial products,
right,
unnatural products. And all of, there's a movement away from unnatural products and a movement towards flavorful, seasonal, local, sustainable products that, you know, are very, very simply cooked. You know, if you have just, again, going back to that tomato, but you can imagine doing that with any vegetable for that matter, or, you know, doing that with any fruit. If you have these amazing strawberries in season, if you were to drizzle just a little bit of balsamic on it, that's all you would need to do. Rather, we see on every table balsamic vinegar in quantities that we've never experienced before. And those things, you know, we mix these things at the table and we do this, but clearly much of it is an inferior product,
mm-hmm,
unbeknownst to the customer. You know, we go to great lengths at Quartino to bring in products that are certified by the Italian government. And in fact, the Italian government had visited Quartino and had given us an award for its authenticity and maintaining the culture. And we weren't seeking that. You know, our complete focus is our customer being able to bring that customer closer to what we're doing. Often I'll take the customer back into the kitchen to see where we dry our sausages, our salumis, and, you know, everybody says they do this. We're willing to prove it and, you know, show them the actual ingredients that we're using. You know, starting for the month of June and the month of July, we're going to be offering freshly shaved summer truffles to our customers.
Oh, boy.
And for a small price of $5, the reason we do that, because they're in season now, and we take advantage of that. The price is low, and we pass that on to the customer, and we want our customer to come back often to have these kinds of seasonal experiences. And you can say, well, summer truffles are not the best, and, you know, I really prefer white truffles, or I'd rather have a winter truffle, whatever the case is. But still, shaved onto a salad at the last moment, I mean, that's an incredible food experience. And if you're able to do that with among family and friends at approachable price points, you'll return time and time again. And, you know, Quartino continues to grow and develop because of this approach and this philosophy. We have 200 people like-minded that work here in order to do this. So there is a tremendous effort taken on each and every one of our staff members in order to produce this.
Well, I mentioned this to you before, and we talked about this when we had the gathering for St. Ignatius upstairs, and the kids, the young people that were working there were so, and I'm going to use the word again, I don't want to be redundant, but welcoming. They were there, whatever you needed, what can I get for you, and so forth. And this is reflective of that person who leads that restaurant, and that's you, and the young people who see what you're doing because that's your personality, it's the type of person that you are. That's how they act. That's how they respond. It's reflective of the restaurant in itself. And that's so very important, too. And you have to be complimented for that, John.
Well, thank you. And I say that humbly. But, you know, more often than not, I think I have more faults than strengths. So, I applaud our staff for embracing and aligning themselves with our vision. And they have been nothing but a pleasure to allow us to push this our passion forward. You know, if you think about it, yes, this is a business. Yes, we, you know, are focused on cooking and serving and doing all of these wonderful things. But at the end of the day, it is a for-profit business, and we respect the fact that we have customers that allow us to make a wonderful living, that allow us to fully have the experiences that we're so passionate about and bring that to their table. I mean, I feel so privileged to be able to do this. More importantly, to continuously develop and learn with our customers what works and what doesn't work, and what they appreciate and what they think, well, really, I really prefer not to eat this. I think you should have left that in Italy where it belongs. and many of those preparations are regional based, and they should stay there or stay within that particular region. And many of them have a broader base, and those are the ones that we look to perfect and we look to emulate to the very, very best of our abilities. And again, bringing that, again, in such a welcoming approach, as you mentioned earlier, I think that is the essence of any great restaurant. We're glad you're here. You know, when I drive many times, I see the slogan for Chicago. You know, it says, "We're glad you're here." That's absolutely right. You know, and it's we share that. I mean, without making someone feel at home, you know, you don't want to feel bad. We all want to feel good.
Sure, sure. Right? What trends do you see coming in restaurants in general, or in particular? How do you see some of the new evolution that you're going to experience at Quartino?
Well, Quartino is our approach is we're going to evolve our salumis, all of our dried meats, looking to have more of that artisan and authentic, rather than using things like truffle oil to make salumis or using inferior products. Our approach is high execution or meticulous execution of those basics, trying to be as seasonally as based as our customers will allow us, and in fact taking some risks when a customer requests, you know, certain things, showing an alternative, not necessarily in a very welcoming and respectable manner, more so in a way that the customer does not realize that we're doing this, but we're on that customer's side, you know, producing fast, efficient service with a lot of personality and foods that are rooted in tradition that reflect tremendous understanding. You know, at the end of May, we're going to be getting to June, you know, so it's time for the summer season, and we're going to be offering, you know, obviously heirloom tomatoes and varieties of other seasonal products that are available. And realize, you know, we do this in the context of somewhere in a neighborhood of 10 to 12,000 people a week.
Wow.
You know, so it's a massive undertaking. It takes tremendous focus. We're looking at evolving our extra virgin olive oil. We've got a producer, a very small artisan producer with limited quantities, both in Tuscany, that we're considering. So there's a lot of great stuff, you know, on our front burners that we're looking to push forward. We've just implemented using the dried pastas that we do use. Four of them are from Gragnano. The fifth one, which we're going to be embarking on shortly, is to make fresh orecchietti all by hand, not machine-made. So, and we have a whole section of fresh pastas that we all make in-house that are done non-mechanically. So we're approaching it very much as though an artisan were to do it in Italy for, you know, a very limited number of people. We're looking to expand and grow without the usage of mechanical assistance. You know, it's great to say, you know, now we got to make 200 pounds of soppressata. Well, our approach is we're going to look into the development of doing this by hand. We made the first step of doing the spianata romana, which is all cut by hand, and then putting that into natural casings, and then drying them and pressing them as they were meant to be done. And we've had superior comments from our customers, so this is what's leading us to do this.
Of course, Quartino is part of the family of the Gibson Group of restaurants, Lux Bar and Gibson's and Hugo's Frog Bar. And the part of Steve Lombardo and Peggy Lombardo, another great Ignatius family.
Absolutely.
And what's the best part of your job, John? Is it dealing with the people?
You know, the most exciting part to my job is being able to bring the foods, the wines of Italy to our customers in a very approachable and understandable way. Our staff is, you know, without the staff, you know, you can say it's like the chicken and the egg. What came first, the staff or the customer, right? And, you know, you can have that discussion for, you know, like I said, the chicken and the egg. But being able to genuinely provide superior food and wine experiences to our customers in a welcoming, approachable format, to me, I feel so fortunate that I'm able to do this. You know, we have the 20-somethings, the 30-somethings, and obviously the 40 and 50-somethings. but the 20 and 30-somethings are getting these authentic Italian food and wine experiences that they normally wouldn't have the ability to experience. This allows us to shape their palate. This allows us to give them a real infusion into the Italian culture, which they normally would not have had.
Yeah.
Had Cortino not existed, I always say, just think how boring it would be. And I say that humbly. I don't say that in a condescending manner. I say it humbly because, you know, we have in very round numbers, you know, 500,000 people walking through the doors of Cortino, you know, and we're open nearly 9 years. So that's almost 400,
A lot of people.
Almost 5 million people have come through the doors of Cortino. We've had a tremendous responsibility, and in fact, it's a fiduciary responsibility to our customers to provide them this very approachable, authentic Italian food and wine experience without having to leave the great city of Chicago.
Well, you say it's your honor, John. It's our honor, and it's my honor to have you on the show because it's a delight to chat with you, certainly, and to get your insight into what's happening at Cortino, what's happening in the restaurant and the culinary world in particular. The quest for simplicity and authenticity in our cooking is defined by a need to shape a distinctive cuisine, acknowledge our roots, attend to the comfort and hospitality of our guests, and search out the highest quality ingredients. The objective is to highlight the intrinsic flavors of those ingredients, and this exploration humbly expresses a love of the land's bounty, simplicity, elegance, and freshness for the pleasure of your palate. Cortino Ristorante and Wine Bar, located at 626 North State, opened its doors in December 2005 and is now entering its ninth year of showcasing the flavors and traditions of Italia's most vibrant region to Chicago diners. Cortino is the recipient of the coveted Ospitalità Italiana, which is awarded by the Italian government and recognizes restaurants which uphold the traditions of Italian culture. Cortino has been featured in local, national, and international publications, including the Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Sun-Times, Today's Chicago Woman, Michigan Avenue Magazine, Food Arts, Plate Magazine, National Culinary Review, USA Today Travel, Il Giornale di Vicenza, Italia a Tavola, and more. And on the line with us right now is the managing partner of Cortino Ristorante and Wine Bar, our good friend John Coletta. Johnny, if you can give me a phone number or something for the restaurant so people could touch base if they would like to come out and enjoy your expertise.
Absolutely. Our phone number is 312-698-5000, and we're located on the corner of Ontario and State, and the address is 626 North State Street. We're open 7 days a week from 11:30 a.m. until 2 a.m. and on Saturdays till 3 a.m. So there's plenty of time to come in and experience the true efforts of our customer-obsessed staff.
A beautiful restaurant, but a beautiful outdoor dining area. And if you'd like to have a special party, upstairs dining rooms and party rooms are available. And the website is CortinoChicago.com. My good friend, it's a delight to chat with you, certainly, and get the word out.
Thank you.
Let's continue the conversation. We'll stop by and see you soon.
I look forward to it, and thank you so much. You have a wonderful day.
God bless you, my pal.
God bless. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Johnny Coletta, one of the great restaurateurs, not only in Chicago, but in the world, very frankly. And what a great restaurant, Cortino Ristorante and Wine Bar. He's got a young one going to St. Ignatius. We had the opportunity of seeing him a couple weeks ago, and he and Steve Lombardo and his staff of the great Gribson Restaurant Group, very proud to be participatory in everything that they do. And if you have a chance, by all means, stop down and see John, 626 North State, right at Ontario, for information, 312-698-5000. 5,000. Charles Darwin's theories about evolution have been a contentious topic for more than 150 years, creating tension between the scientific and religious communities. And unless you are a Darwin scholar, you may not know that these revolutionary ideas also were a topic of discussion between Darwin and his religious wife, Emma. Theirs was a passionate debate about science versus faith. Continuing its 26th season, Looking Glass Theatre Company presents the world premiere of In the Garden, Our Darwinian Love Story, by artistic associate Sarah Gemeter and directed by Jessica Thebus. In the Garden runs through June 29th at Looking Glass Theatre Company, located inside Chicago's historic Water Tower Waterworks, 821 North Michigan at Pearson. Long before The Origin of Species will forever change the world, Charles Darwin meets Emma Wedgwood, and they forever change each other. In the space between science and faith, they find an unexpected and unlikely romance. In the Garden chronicles the struggle of two fiercely independent individuals, divided by ideology but united by a fire that fuels a passionate lifelong debate, evolution versus salvation. Only by embracing this duality can they possibly navigate the struggles, triumphs, losses, and discoveries that await. And on the line with us right now is the award-winning actor, writer, director, and ensemble member of Looking Glass Theater. Andrew has most recently appeared in Ethan Frome, wrote Eastland, a new musical, and Of One Blood, and won a Jefferson Award for his adaptation of Orwell's 1984. Teacher, mentor, co-founder of Mosaic Experience, a company which uses an arts-based approach to dialogue about diversity, and the artistic director of Looking Glass, now starring as Charles Darwin in the world premiere of In the Garden, A Darwinian Love Story at Looking Glass Theater in the Water Tower Waterworks Building through June 29th. And on the line with us right now is Mr. Andrew White. Andrew, welcome to the Kevin Moore Show.
Thank you so much, Kevin. It's nice to be here. I'm happy to have you.
Well, I'll tell you what, a delight to spend some time with you in the theater. Somebody we all know about, Darwin, of course, The Origin of Species, but now we have a personality to the face, and you do it so very well because you make it approachable, Andy.
Thank you. That's kind of, you know, I would really credit the playwright with that because she, A, did her research, and she did exhaustive research on the man, not just the science, but the man himself. And so she's written a play that really makes him very human. So I'm just a lucky guy who gets to speak the great language. That is both, some of it which is, you know, scientific, but really is really much more about his personal life, his relationship, as your introduction alludes to, with his wife, Emma, who was a devout Christian. So it's an amazing story. It's full of this lifelong conversation that the two of them had. And it's a delight to do every night.
You know, you make him approachable, as does Sarah, in putting the play together. Sometimes likable, sometimes not likable, but isn't that the conundrum sometimes when you deal with somebody that's so very focused on what their vocation, avocation, and interests are? Darwin, an evolutionist, a scientist, biologist, Emma, a creationist, a spirituality type of person, salvation, Christian Bible, God-centered, yet very much in love.
I think that's absolutely right, and, you know, I think, you know, all of us have our likable moments and our unlikable moments. Yes, Darwin is certainly completely obsessed and focused on the science, and Emma very much faith-based. I think in some ways the first scene of the play where you see young Emma and young Charles really as children, and they're both equally fascinated by a spider web. You know, she says, hey, you want to come see a cool spider web? And he says, yeah, sure. So they check it out, and I think they look at this amazing thing, this amazing work. And she looks at it and sees God, the work of God, and he looks at it and is fascinated by the question of why, what is the science behind it. But they're both two individuals who are completely filled with wonder. And I think you see that throughout the play, and that wonder is what animates their quest for answers. She turns to God for answers, he turns to science. But they're both, again, filled with wonder, which is, I think, a really fun thing to see on stage.
One of the interesting lines, Andy, that Emma recites to Charles is, can't you just please believe in the possibility of a God a bit, Charles? Which is kind of interesting because at one time, Darwin did believe in God to a bit.
Well, and he maintained a belief in God throughout. I think he evolved, if you'll pardon the term, towards the end of his life. I was just reading some writings, and he says, you know, I think agnostic is probably the closest description to what my current frame of mind is. He never denied the existence of God. He never would not have signed on to an atheistic creed. I think he would have characterized himself as a deist for much of his life. But so he acknowledged the existence, or he felt like there was a God. What I think they disagreed about, and as they do sort of get into it, is she says, "What about his active presence? It's his active God's active presence in the world that you doubt here and now in this room, in our lives." Making a difference in our lives, and he says, yes, that is what I doubt. There may be a God who sort of set things in motion, don't know, but I because I don't have any evidence.
Yeah, right.
I can't find the evidence for it.
Right.
And she says, what do you mean you can't find the evidence? The evidence is all around us. Look at a child's smile. Is that not evidence? He says, no, that's evidence of a child's smile. So you've got this just, you know, and these are things we will never know. We will never have the answer to, which is, again, one of the things that I think makes it such a very alive conversation, very alive debate.
You know, we joked about it a little earlier. Here's a gentleman who says to his wife, honey, I'm going to go down to Starbucks for a cup of coffee, and comes back 5 years later after traveling the world.
Yeah, he goes on the Beagle. In fact, before they get married, but he goes on this this journey, and he thinks it'll take, you know, he signs on to it for, I think, a two-year jaunt, a two-year voyage. And, yeah, it turns into a five-year voyage on the Beagle, and they go all around the world, and really changes his life because, of course, he sees things that most British people at the time didn't see anything of. He literally has the entire world open to him, up to him, in all of its glory, seeing colors of animals and birds and insects and flora and fauna that, you know, very few British scientists at the time had seen. And he's seeing it all and seeing this incredible array of nature. And that's what he brings back. He brings back fossils. He brings back, you know, the samples themselves, but also his writings and his awareness of the enormous range of creation.
And maybe that's the secret word, Andrew, that sets Darwin apart from other people during the early 1800s or Victorian England, is his unique awareness of things that other people took for granted and never viewed things the way he viewed them.
Yeah, no, he was seeing things for the first time. There were other explorers who would go out and report things and send back samples and bring things back with them. He wasn't the only one who ever did it, but he certainly was putting an exhaustive level of detail to his writing. And to his, to the science of it, and his examination and his observation and analysis that few had done before, or since, really, for that matter. So he really was an incredible observer, an incredible naturalist by training. Those are the skills that he brought to all of his work, was just an incredible level of detail and observation.
Interesting the way Sarah did her research, because as I was doing some research on Darwin, at his home he had a sand walk, and where he would go and do his ruminations and his thinking and so forth. And you, in the play, you're seen walking around the stage area, much like he must have done as he was thinking about some of his theories or putting things together in his own mind.
Yeah, it's lovely. He's got, you know, he clearly spent a lot of time in his office and in his library and at his desk and in front of a microscope. But yes, he would sort of, he had a pretty regular schedule, and he always had took these little walks. Supposedly he would sort of place rocks on the path that he could kick to sort of make sure that he was, I think, getting his mind out of its usual habits, so that he would continually avoid staying in a rut for too long. And I love being able to do that. We've set up this little perimeter around the main section of the stage that sort of represents and alludes or evokes that that sand walk that he spent a lot of time on.
You had mentioned yourself, Andy, that you were reading some of the writings of Darwin. As you're putting a play like this together, of course, Sarah has an outline, of course, a template of what she wants to do and put on the stage. in your own research, in doing that, do you contribute to the formation of this play?
Well, as an act, I guess theater by definition is a very collaborative effort, right? You've got all of these different people bringing in their skills and talents and brains into a room. So the playwright certainly brings in her, in this instance, the script. And sometimes at Looking Glass we do original work. Well, we often do original work, and sometimes it will change a great deal. This one was a pretty finished script. Even then, it still changes a lot over the course of rehearsal and then over previews once you get the audience and they're giving you a response. As an actor with this one, really, I didn't want or need to add a lot of lines, but hopefully I'm bringing what you talked about at the beginning is those aspects of me and those aspects of my personality that help fill this character out, make him feel approachable, make him feel real and human instead of just the guy we've heard about or that I once learned about vaguely in fifth grade science or in college or whatever. So, contributing that way. And, of course, the director takes all of that input and as well as the work from the designers and shapes the whole picture that you as the audience get to see and perform has performed before you.
Now, you as an actor are responding that way, but you also, as Andrew Wright, the actor, writer, director, and ensemble member, do you have any or feel you should throw a little input on there, or are you happy to say, well, I'll act this one, you handle the direction?
It's kind of true. I think it's the latter. It's true when I'm in my role as artistic director here at Looking Glass, often involved with helping give feedback and input into we very strongly follow the lead artist and let them be the ones who are asking the questions, and we hope to give them some good feedback that will help them get the work to where they want it to be. With this production, it has been really nice, I must say, to just be an actor for the most part and really let, because I have no objectivity. I can't see what it looks like. I'm in it. Mm-hmm. So I leave it to wiser minds than mine, and there are many of them, who are looking at it, and they're able to go, oh, here's what the whole arc of the story is. Here's what, needs to be beefed up, or here's what needs to come out, so that we can really see the story more clearly. It's impossible for me, who is in it, to do that with any objectivity at all. And so that is, and actually remains a real pleasure for me, is to just go out there and just be the actor.
Well, we're certainly enjoying that. What's next up for Andy White?
Well, we have, it's both Andy White and Looking Glass together, as in my capacity at Looking Glass. We've got Cascabel next, which is this fantastic show with Rick Bayless,
right.
The chef, and he'll be in it, and this will be at the Goodman. This is a production we did 2 years ago. It is this amazing fusion of circus and dinner, and, if you've ever been to any Rick Bayless restaurant, you know how good the food is, and it is an incredible meal. So circus and theater and music and food, that starts end of July. So we're already certainly turning our attention there to the pre-production elements necessary for that. That's really going to be just a fun, thrilling evening. And then the 14-15 season begins right after that, literally, kind of the day, I think 3 days after the Cascabel closes, we begin rehearsals for Death Tax, which kicks off our 14-15 season.
Well, always something interesting and fascinating going on at Looking Glass. Of course, we just enjoyed The Little Prince, which was wonderful production, and you guys just do a terrific job. It's great to be part of the great theater world in Chicago.
It's an amazing town for city for theater. This city is bar none the best in the country. It really produces more great theater than any other city around.
Inventive, collaborative, transformative, Looking Glass Theater Company, recipient of the 2011 Regional Theater Tony Award, was founded in 1988 by 8 Northwestern University students. Now in its 26th season, Looking Glass is home to a multidisciplined ensemble of artists who create story-centered theatrical work that is physical, orally rich, and visually metaphoric. The company has staged 61 world premieres, received 101 Joseph Jefferson Awards and nominations, and work premiered at Looking Glass has been produced across the United States. The Looking Glass Theater in Chicago's landmark Water Tower Waterworks opened in June 2003. In addition to developing and presenting ensemble work, Looking Glass education and community programs encourage creativity, teamwork, and confidence with thousands of community members each year. Continuing its 26th season, Looking Glass Theater presents the world premiere of In the Garden, the Darwinian love story by artistic associate Sarah Gemitter and directed by Jessica Thebus. In the Garden runs through June 29th at Looking Glass Theater Company, located inside Chicago's historic Water Tower Waterworks, 821 North Michigan, at Pearson. And on the line with us right now is the artistic director and star of In the Garden, a Darwinian love story, Mr. Andrew White. Andrew, I'm going to give a phone number for people who would like to get some tickets, 312-337-0665. A delight to chat with you, and certainly congratulations on In the Garden, a Darwinian love story, and the extension that's enjoying right now.
Thank you, Kevin. I love talking about it, so thanks for having me on.
And certainly we'll continue our conversation about the great things that are happening with Looking Glass. I'm sure Kathy Taylor will make sure I do.
Great.
Have a great summer.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks, Andy.
Bye.
Andrew White, one of the very talented people of Chicago theater, and starring in the Garden, a Darwinian love story. Starring is Charles Darwin and his relationship with his bride, Emma Wedgwood, at Looking Glass Theater Company, located inside Chicago's historic Water Tower Waterworks, 821 North Michigan at Pearson. For information, 312-337-0665. Well, that about does it for our show today. I thank you for sharing this last hour with me and hope you, our listeners, have enjoyed this time as much as I have. I'd especially like to thank our guest, Mr. John Kletter, a good friend, the chef and managing partner of Cortino Ristorante and Wine Bar, located at 626 North State Street at Ontario. What a delightful chat with John. I suppose we could spend an entire hour talking about food and wine and the culinary arts. And now that he's a St. Ignatius parent and a proud member of the St. Ignatius family, it's great to have him on the show and chat a little bit. For information, 312-698-5000, one of Chicago's most popular restaurants and a member of the Gibson Hospitality Group. And Mr. Andrew White. Andy is the artistic director of Looking Glass Theater, now starring as Charles Darwin in the play In the Garden, a Darwinian love story, through June 29th. For information, 312-337-0665. Finally, a famous writer once said, one ought, every day at least, to hear a little song, read a good poem, see a fine picture, and if it were possible, to speak a few reasonable words. I hope on our show today we have, at the very least, done just that, spoken a few reasonable words. At that, I'd like to wish everyone a good week. And as that British group once said, and in the end, the love that you take is equal to the love that you make. Happy June!
The way I feel for you, it's now or never. The more I love, the more that I'm afraid. In your eyes I may not see forever. Forever. If we can be the best of lovers, yet be the best of friends. If we can try with every day to make it better as it grows, any luck then I suppose. The music, the music.